good morning, and thanks very much. And I'll apologize up front that this is a brand new project, and so I won't have lots of results to share with you yet. However, I'm sure if you're patient at a future meeting, we'll have lots of exciting results to share with you. So the sustainability of fruit and vegetable production is very much in the news these days, especially here in the United States, because of the drought in California. As I'm sure you're very well aware, there's been an extended drought out there. And you're probably also aware that California is the place where most domestic fruits and vegetables are produced. And I'll have some numbers on that later, but I think many people realize that. We heard as we were talking about this project that Secretary Vilsack of USDA himself is very concerned about this issue. And has even asked his people to think about where we might move fruit and vegetable production in the U.S. And I know there was a recent workshop at Boulder on this topic, and some of you in the room may have been there. We had Dick McNider at a workshop that I'll be speaking about participate in our session that we had earlier this year. And I know that there's a lot of infrastructure issues, obviously, associated with moving fruits and vegetables around. So it's not a minor issue at all, but it is absolutely a long-term concern for the U.S. and maybe even a short-term concern as well. But as you can see here from this other news story in a different part of the world, olive oil prices have surged recently because of drought and disease in Spain and Italy. And I'm sure many of you are aware that the climate models tell us that the areas around the Mediterranean are among the areas that are likely to suffer some of the worst consequences of climate change. And those areas obviously produce many fruits and vegetables. And so therefore, I believe that we're headed to a future where some of these crops are in fact going to be moving around due to some of these particular issues. And it should be emphasized that moving these things around is not nearly as simple as taking wheat varieties and moving them north, for instance, as an adaptation strategy. There's an awful lot of infrastructure that goes with moving perennial crops around the planet. So the other thing that's happening is, believe it or not, this may be surprising to some folks, but as we look around at our children, I still have a seventh grader, and I know she's not eating very many fruits and vegetables, but the data would suggest that we are experiencing slight increases in the consumption of fruits and vegetables. The only other thing that our children are eating more of, which is no surprise to me, is dessert. They like sugar, obviously, and my guess is that the fruits are outweighing the vegetables in terms of increases because of how much we crave sugar. So, but overall, in all seriousness, there is a growing emphasis on nutrition, obviously, in our food systems, and I think that's rightly placed. Given the challenges that we have with obesity and all sorts of diseases associated with obesity in this country. So just a brief word about our group at the Research Foundation. I see a couple of folks out here, obviously Ken in particular, who's been a partner with us, and Cheryl as well. Our mission at SIMSANS, and that stands for the Center for Integrated Modeling of Sustainable Ag and Nutrition Security. I did not come up with a name for the center, but I was just given it, and I was told you're going to run the center, so that's what I've been doing. But we're all about partnerships, leading partnerships on improving the modeling that's being used to understand and better inform adaptation to climate change, extreme events, and resource scarcity on something we're calling sustainable nutrition security. And for those of you who aren't familiar with ILSI or the ILSI Research Foundation, we are always employ what we call the tripartite approach. So all the work we do is for the public good. It's open, it's transparent, but it involves scientists from industry, from government, and academia, and now in certain cases NGOs as well. One of the things that we did last year, and I Ken was a co-author on this, was produce a white paper called Assessing Sustainable Nutrition Security, the Role of Food Systems. And again, same sort of tripartite representation on the authorship of this document. You can Google that and find it. Another report that came out earlier this year is one that we collaborated with a number of authors, primarily in the UK, but some US folks as well. And this considered the question of a multiple breadbasket failure in our food systems and some of the political, social, economic consequences of such an event. And we're finding that the insurance industry around the world is growing increasingly concerned about this because they need to be properly capitalized for a 1 in 200 year risk. And currently, we don't even know what a 1 in 200 year event might be with respect to disruption of calorie production around the world. So this is an increasing concern to governments and currently doesn't even consider fruits and vegetables, although those are obviously very important. So this is a diagram that we shared at a workshop that AgMIP held at Aspen earlier this year, and it really emphasizes the role of the food system with respect to sustainable nutrition security. And there are a number of activities ongoing here. We just saw a presentation about crop modeling, but there's obviously also animal models, economic models, life cycle assessment modeling, and some food system metrics that I'll talk about in a moment that all go into defining and measuring food security and diet. So this is what integrated modeling is all about, and it's an emerging area of science and one that that we are trying to improve upon through our work at the ILSI Research Foundation, just emphasizing there at the bottom that this is not just about the long-term effects of climate change, but also about the increase in extreme events that we're seeing right now, which was the emphasis of the UK report. So this is just a quick diagram from a paper that we're about to share publicly for some broad stakeholder feedback, but it's been our main area of focus here over the past several months at the Research Foundation. These are various metrics of food system performance. And you can see there a number of things. One of them is resilience down at the bottom there, and that speaks to not just climate change, but other aspects of resilience. We consider sustainability very broadly, so we're not just talking about environmental sustainability, such as greenhouse gas emissions, but we also consider such issues as sociocultural well-being, affordability, and availability. And many of these topics are ones that other groups have already developed individual indicators for, and so we're relying upon that literature as opposed and trying to coordinate very closely with other groups who are looking at ways to measure sustainability as we develop the system. This, again, is a diagram from that paper that shows one way of using these metrics. In this particular case, we're comparing the sustainable nutrition security status of food systems in 9 different countries around the world. I obviously don't have time to get into detail here, but I just want to give you a flavor for how these are done, and happy to answer questions that people have afterwards. So in terms of how are we going to add fruits and vegetables to these modeling assessments, we're really, for those of you who are experts, know very well that up until now, there really has been no consideration of fruits and vegetables when we talk about long-term viability of our agri-food system. So we began this process with a workshop that was held at UC Davis earlier this year. It had multiple representatives from the food industry, the agricultural industry, as well as many academics and government scientists as well, where we agreed upon the objectives for what we're calling a fruit and vegetable sustainability assessment that we're just now beginning. We selected the crops and the geographies and the modeling methods, including both mechanistic crop models of the type that we just saw, but also statistically based models such as have been used by David LaBelle's group at Stanford and other groups to look at crops where we really don't have today mechanistic crop models. And as I mentioned earlier in the presentation, California is far and away the leading producer of most fruits and vegetables here in the U.S. and really dwarfs all other states. Washington State, which is actually my home state, and Florida are a very distant second and third with respect to California on both fruits and vegetables. You're not going to be able to read this, but just to emphasize that we've already done an analysis looking at the top 30 specialty crops in the U.S., and we've documented there that one of those three states, that is California, Florida, or Washington, is either 1, 2, or 3 with respect to the production of all of those crops, with the exception of pecans, pumpkins, blueberries, and I think that's it. So, in fact, we think it makes a lot of sense to focus our analysis initially on those three states. Both Washington and Florida, for many of these crops, would actually or could be logical places to be producing more of those crops. Obviously very different types of climate. We're talking about two opposite corners of the United States, but there's more plentiful water, especially in Washington State, but to a large extent in Florida as well. And irrigation is key to producing all of these. So we've selected a particular list of crops based on the assessment that we did together back in July. What we're going to do is focus on those three states and also the current and near term, defined as within 20 years or so, climate and water availability impacts on yield, but quality also and price for these crops. For those of you who are familiar with the fruit and vegetable business, yield is really typically not of that much concern to them, especially in an irrigated system. What is of concern is quality, because it's all about something that a consumer will actually purchase from the store. And so if you don't have a nice-looking bell pepper, for instance, the consumer is not going to purchase it. So we've assembled a team of scientists from UC Davis, where we're getting hydrology modeling expertise, University of Florida, where we're getting mechanistic crop modeling expertise, University of Illinois, which is actually Kai-Yu Guan, who just is leaving David LaBelle's group and joining the University of Illinois. But we're also collaborating with IFPRI, that's the International Food Policy Research Institute, which runs the leading integrated model with respect to the number of foods that it considers. And then a small economic consulting group called WAIS, which is based in Columbia, Missouri, and the lead there is a gentleman named John Cruz, who does economic modeling work for USDA and a number of folks in the private sector, and in fact has already developed a number of vegetable models that are used by industry. So unlike the description in the abstract that was submitted several months ago, we're currently envisioning this as a 2 to 3 year study, and we are going to be submitting a pre-proposal to USDA NEFA Specialty Crop Research Initiative here in just a couple weeks, actually, to get this work started. And we believe that we have a very good chance for getting this work done, especially because of the interest at very high levels of USDA in this topic. There's a chance that the drought will end in California soon because of El Nino and how strong it is this year. But I think the jury is still out on that. And even if this one, in fact, does end soon, as we all hope, because of climate change, we expect that the recurrence of those droughts is going to be more common and that they will become more intense over time. So there really is a long-term concern with respect to many of these crops, and we hope to answer those questions and help decision makers institute policies or investments that will cause us to continue to have good production of these crops and perhaps even increases in the availability of affordable fruits and vegetables here in the U.S., which is obviously a huge part of a healthy and nutritious diet. So with that, just want to thank you once again. Sorry, apologies for the lack of results, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions?
Cheryl. Yes, absolutely. So IFPRI, the main reason that they're involved is they obviously do international work. The main reason for focusing on the U.S. initially is that that's the key target donor, which is USDA. But the methods that we develop, we absolutely want to be able to apply them globally, assuming good data availability. One of the easier places to include very quickly would be Chile, for instance, which is an important producer of some of these crops for the U.S., and very similar climatic situation to California. But there are many other areas around the world where these crops are produced, these specific ones, and we would like to include those. Mexico comes to mind as well, Brazil possibly, for oranges, for instance. Well, yeah, because Garrett didn't want to come to the meeting. I don't know if he's in the room or not, but I'm being flippant here. But, we did invite Garrett, and in fact, another gentleman there, who's Stockel? Is that his last name, Ken? Yeah. He wasn't able to do it. We could absolutely add folks from Washington State. So if there's representatives of Washington State and the university in the room, I grew up in Spokane, so I'm a huge Cougar fan for football fans out there. So I'd love to include someone there, but we didn't have anyone at the workshop, but there's still time to increase the size of the team. So please reach out to me if there's any interest on the part of Washington State. Well, to be honest, I think the team is favoring mechanistic models first, by far. However, the reality of the situation is that for several of those crops, there are some models available, but not nearly the level of sophistication that we have for some of the crops. So I'll just call out one in particular. It's not much of a vegetable, but for instance, potatoes. We have some rather good, well-advanced mechanistic models for potatoes, but perhaps not for apples, and perhaps not for oranges. And I know there are some models, and I sense that you perhaps are from Australia, and I'm sorry if I don't recognize you. I know that there are some models down there. We don't currently have an immediate collaborator that has access to those kinds of models, but we'd absolutely be open to including them. But the assessment of the group that we had assembled at UC Davis that was that we probably would be better off using the statistical approaches, which in fact have already been successfully employed by Lavelle and his co-authors for several of these crops for an assessment that's already been done for the state of California. So we're not starting from scratch there. There's already quite a lot of work that's been done. But wide open, so our preference is for mechanistic models first, to be honest. But if not available, then go with a statistical approach. Well, yeah, and the focus is going to be on current impacts of the climate change that's already here, and what I'm describing is near term. So this is not end of century type stuff. This is now through, say, 20 years out. And there, I think, is where the statistical models are actually help, you know, in some cases might even be better than mechanistic, but we can debate that on a different day, probably.
We're going to have to move to the next speaker.
Okay, I apologize. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you very much.